1995, Houston oil executives host a Taliban delegation in Houston. George W. Bush, governor of Texas. They want to build a pipeline through Afghanistan to bring the natural gas from Central Asia through Afghanistan into Pakistan and out to the sea. Who's going to help build the pipeline? A company called Halliburton. Who's the head of Halliburton? Cheney. This stuff starts to stink to the high heavens, especially when you look at the money that Halliburton made rebuilding Kuwait after Daddy's War over there. And who helped Halliburton rebuild Kuwait? Who made the billions and the millions off this? A company called Enron. Enron and Halliburton rebuilding Kuwait. Oh, I don't want to go there, man. This really sucks. How bad does this get? We don't want to know, do we? We don't really want to know.
That's Michael Moore, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm Jeff Friesen. This edition of AR features Michael Moore on Stupid White Men. By chance, Michael Moore's new book, Stupid White Men, was printed on September 10th, 2001. The next day, the publishers suddenly considered Moore's book inappropriate. Moore's publisher claimed that a book with sections like Kill Whitey and a letter asking Bush to resign would not go over well in post-9/11 America. They asked him to rewrite half the book, but Moore refused. The book languished for months in the warehouse. Disgruntled librarians finally broke the stalemate. They yelled censorship, and the publisher cried mercy, finally shipping the book in its original form. Although opinion polls announced unprecedented support for Bush and the war, Moore's supposedly unpatriotic book shot to the top of bestseller lists, shocking the profiteers and pundits. Moore first brought his humorous and radical analysis to mainstream audiences with the award-winning documentary Roger and Me. His television series include The Awful Truth and the Emmy-winning TV Nation. His first book, Downsize This, was a bestseller. Moore's upcoming film is Bowling for Columbine. He spoke at a sold-out theater in Boulder, Colorado.
This book, Stupid White Men, a few months ago wasn't supposed to come out. The publisher, HarperCollins, told me that that I had not done the right thing. I wrote this book last summer, and it was printed on 50,000 copies of it were printed on September 10th. And so, yeah, so it's supposed to be shipped the next day. Of course, it wasn't. And in the weeks after that, HarperCollins wasn't really shipping any books, which was fine with me. I didn't want to go on a book tour or do anything with this. And, you know, it was rough enough. I live in Manhattan. And, you know, we knew people that had died there at the tower. And firemen on our neighborhood, dead, 21 of them. So that was fine, and HarperCollins said, we'll just wait a few weeks and see what happens. And a few weeks went. A few more weeks came and went. And I called them up, and I said, what do you think of putting the book out? What do you think? And, you know, just, I'm whatever you think is best, great, you know, whatever. I'm open to, I can get back to work here and stuff. And they said, well, Mike,
we have a problem with your book. The political climate in America has changed. And we believe that your book is no longer in keeping or fitting for the climate as it exists.
I said, well, since when did you guys become meteorologists? You know, what's this? What do you mean climate? Well, Mike, it's United We Stand now behind the president, and people do not want to hear criticisms of him, and this book is way too harsh against Mr. Bush. We'd like you to take out a couple of chapters in this book. There's a letter in here, that, as you know, you wrote to him, where you ask him if he's a drunk, a thief, or an illiterate. And that's got to go. You also write about him stealing the election here, and it's called A Very American Coup. That's got to go. And this chapter here, the title, Kill Whitey. As I'm sure you understand, Mike, with America under attack like this, Whitey is not really the problem right now.
And I said, Whitey is always the problem. So they said, well, we don't want to censor you. We'd just like you to rewrite 50% of the book. Tone down your dissent. Take out these harsh criticisms. Maybe you could write a new chapter. A post-September 11th chapter. Your thoughts and feelings after September 11th. And I said, yeah, well, that chapter would be called The Sad and Sordid Whereabouts of Bin Cheney and Bin Bush. That's not the chapter we had in mind. You got to change the title, Mike, too. Stupid White Men. No. Come up with something else. Any ideas? Yes, I have an idea. I'd change the title to Bring Me the Head of Antonin Scalia. That wasn't the title we had in mind. We were thinking of changing it to Michael Moore, the American. I said, isn't that like a little obvious or redundant? Michael Moore, overweight. I said, and we get it, you know? I mean, you can, you know? And in addition to rewriting 50% of the book and changing the title and the cover, we'd like you to give us $100,000 to reprint the book for the 50,000 copies we already printed. Oh, yeah, sure. Hang on. Let me just get that out of my back pocket. You want me to pay you for the privilege of censoring myself? I mean, that's what, I mean, are you nuts? I'm not rewriting 50% of one word. All right? And, you know, I'm not going to the press. I'm not making any deal. I'm thinking, I'm going to work behind the scenes here. I'm going to quietly figure this out. This is really weird. I've never had this happen to me before where, you know, because usually the profit motive reigns supreme. That's how I've been able to get all my work out there, because as long as millions of people will come to the movie or watch the TV show or buy the book, they turn their head away from the politics because I'm making them a bunch of bucks. You know, it's like that. It's that great flaw of capitalism. The rich man will sell you the rope to hang himself with. I mean, that's why I get to do this. That and the fact that they believe that once you read the book or watch the movie, we'll do nothing about it. They're so convinced. It's 200 million voters in this country, people of voting age. 154 million did not vote for George W. Bush. We should feel good about that. Just think of the 200 million voting age Americans, 154 million did not vote for Bush. Well, I wouldn't change anything in the book. You know, I got the lawyer involved and the agent and all those people, you know, and they're like, now, Mike, think about your career. I said, you sound like my high school guidance counselor. I was like, I've never had a career. It's like, what career? If I had ever stopped it once in my life to think about my career, I'd never be standing on this stage tonight. I mean, seriously, if I had, when I set out to make Roger and Me, if I had had even one inkling of a thought in my head, you know what? Maybe I'll get a deal and have Warner Brothers distribute this film. I'll get a Hollywood studio to distribute this, and millions will see it. If I had been thinking like that, that movie would have sucked, and you never would have seen it. You know? It's only because I didn't give a shit, and I was just going to tell the truth as I saw it, that I ended up kind of giving a shit a lot. You know? It's kind of, that's how I've lived my whole life. I've just never really given a crap about anything about the things that they want you to give a crap about. Well, you know what I'm saying? It's like, Back and forth. The editor calls me and goes, Mike, it's not looking very good. You haven't agreed to do anything. You won't compromise. Book's been sitting in the warehouse now for 3 or 4 months. Looks like we're going to have to pulp the books. Pulp. We're going to pulp. I never heard this word used as a verb. To pulp. We're going to pulp the books. Pulp. You know, we're going to pulp them, turn them into pulp, and then back into paper so we can print more Rush Limbaugh books or Bill O'Reilly books or, you know. I got so depressed. And I thought, damn, this is actually, we should feel good about this. Think of how far we've come. Think about, we should all give ourselves a pat on the back that we've come this far, that even the oppressors are thinking of recycling. Even, you know, I mean, really, right in the same sentence that they're going to deny me my freedom of speech and expression, they're going to pulp the books. Not going to shred them. Not going to put them in a landfill somewhere. Not going to toss them out the window like a Burger King wrapper. No, they're going to pulp the books. Save the trees. Screw Mike. Save the trees. Screw Mike. Well, the next day, I go out to New Jersey. I'm scheduled to give this talk at the annual meeting of New Jersey Citizen Action. It's like 90 people out there somewhere in New Jersey. I go out there. I said, look, I'm not going to talk about what I was originally going to talk about. Something happened last night. It doesn't look like this book I wrote, a book I'm very proud of, a book that deals with a lot of the issues that are going on right now and about Bush, about, you know, our prison culture, our sucky school systems, our, you know, the whole thing about, you know, the male gender I belong to and the racism, the open cancer on our society that we refuse to deal with, and all these things I wanted to write about, and some things that, you know, that, and this is, you know, stuff I'd written about, I started writing about it last April. Ken Lay, Enron, Arthur Anderson, little bits and pieces of this of them in this book, because I just kind of felt this is really weird, you know. So I said to the people in the audience, I said, look, no one's going to get to read this book. I just have this horrible feeling. I'd like to read you a couple chapters because you may be the only ones to hear these words. So I read a couple chapters of the book. And unbeknownst to me, there's this woman in the audience, a librarian, somebody I don't know. Just a librarian. She goes home, gets on the internet, and gets into these librarian chat rooms. Are you aware that librarians are meeting in chat rooms on the internet? Did anyone know this? Are there any librarians present? I thought this was a Christina Aguilera, you know, Britney Spears kind of thing, you know. They're in chat rooms. Anyway, she gets into these chat rooms, and she gets them all lathered up about Michael Moore's book's going to be banned by HarperCollins. We got to do something. They get together. They write a letter. They send it out to all the librarians on the librarian listserv. It goes out to thousands of librarians. This incredible letter. I discovered this is one group you do not want to piss off, man. No, I'm serious. I mean, they've had their budget slashed. They aren't paid shit, you know. The books are 30 years old. They scotch taping them together every night. They're on the ass end of everything, the librarians, man. Now think about this. Who gives a shit about the libraries anymore? We have Barnes & Noble, you know. No. So these librarians are writing these letters. Unbelievable. They just like flood the email of HarperCollins with, you know, these letters. And it's like, you know, I'm thinking, you know, this is one terrorist group you do not want to mess with, you know. You think they're just sitting there all day, you know, all mousy and quiet, you know. They just want you to be quiet because they're sitting there trying to plot the revolution. They're going to get their revenge. So Monday morning rolls along. I get a call from the publisher at HarperCollins. What did you tell the librarians? I don't know any librarians. What do you mean, what did I tell them? You said something to the librarians.
We're getting a lot of hate mail from librarians. Oh, God bless this woman, man. I'll tell you, it just threw the fear of God into them. I mean, it's like, you know, it was just incredible. And a couple days later, 3-4 days later, they made up their minds and they said, "You win. We're going to put the book out just as you wanted it, just uncensored, untouched, just as it's printed. And good luck, Mike, because you're out of touch with the American people. And this book is not going to sell. We're going to send you on a 3-city tour. New York, Ridgewood, New Jersey, and Arlington, Virginia." I was already sitting in New York. They weren't sending me there. Ridgewood, New Jersey, and Arlington, Virginia. Okay, fine. The book's going to bomb. It's going to die. Okay. Well, within 24 hours of its release, it goes to number one on the Amazon.com bestseller list. All 24 hours later, it goes to number one on the Publisher's Weekly bestseller list. It debuts at number one on the BookSense independent bookstore list. It just goes to number one immediately on virtually all the bestseller lists. In the first 5 days, the book went into its ninth printing. It sold more copies in its first week than Downsize This did in its first year. They can't keep enough books in the bookstores. They are so blown away by this. They're all back in New York, the pundits and the publishers, and they're all going, whoa, what about the 80% approval ratings? We thought the country was United We Stand. Yeah, maybe it is United We Stand against Bush, you know? These people, man, they think they know this country. They don't know this country. This is a very liberal, progressive country. And for those of you who like to just relish in the fact that the only kind of progressive thought goes on in a place like this, you should really take a look at your fellow Americans, because in addition to the 154 million who did not want Bush as president of the United States, you've got another... You look at any of the polls that were taken in the pre-Ashcroft repression era, where I don't trust the polls right now, because I think anybody getting a call at 9 o'clock at night, you know, during these creepy times from a stranger wanting to know, do you approve of the president of the United States? I mean, what's the average American going to say to that? Yes, I approve. I approve. Don't take me away. My wife approves. The dogs approve. The cat approves. Approve, cat. Cat. Of course he's got 80%. Of course he's got 80%. The average working class or poor American knows it's their kids that are going to die over there. You know? So their inclination at first is to try and, you know, they don't want to say anything or do anything that might hurt their kids. You know, also, the country was attacked. 3,000 people were killed. It's a natural human reaction to feel a little threatened by something like that. It's okay to feel that way. And usually human beings, when they feel that way, rally behind the leader. You know, he just happens to be who we're stuck with. You know, that's what, I mean... The American public does not love George W. Bush. If this is more like love the one you're with, you know? No, don't. Don't buy this 80. And frankly, last Sunday, it was down, was already down in the 70s or on its way to the 60s. It was at its lowest point since before September 11th. It's gone down because the American people, like I said, the 180 million aren't stupid. They get it. They know what this guy's about. Enron has reminded them, you know, just how scary this guy can be. You know, this company that bought and paid for this administration.
They know this. They're scared. The average American's scared that their 401k is not going to be there. If this can happen to the seventh largest corporation that's best friends with the president that bought the administration, if it could happen to them, who else could it happen to? Right? That's what they're worried about. That's what they're thinking about. He's frightened the country now. He's frightened the country. I'm much more concerned about him than any, you know, these invisible boogeymen that I'm supposed to be afraid of. I mean, seriously. What am I afraid of? I'm afraid that this coming to a place like Boulder or any of the other cities I go to on this tour, that after I go, nobody will do anything. I'm afraid that you're here tonight, looking at me as somebody who's going to lead something, and this will never happen if we exist in a celebrity culture where, you know, a Michael Moore or a Ralph Nader or whoever is going to make this happen. It will only happen if you get off your ass and do something. That's what I'm afraid of. I'm not afraid of the boogeyman Osama bin Laden, you know, because I haven't fallen for this since about day three of the new war, you know. Here's what totally changed my attitude about this. I was reading a story in the Washington Post, I don't know, it was a few days after. Buried deep in the story is a paragraph that says Osama bin Laden is on dialysis. Are you aware of this? So you mean you're telling me that this guy, who's the mastermind of all the evil in the world, he is everywhere. He could be in this room tonight. You're telling me that the evildoer is hooked up to a kidney machine in a cave in Afghanistan? We're going to go over there and bomb the shit out of this country and kill civilians to find a guy who's running from cave to cave hooked up to a dialysis machine? Am I stupid? Are we stupid? Yes or no? There seems to be a split decision in here. I can't take it anymore. You know, it's like, then I pick up the November 12th New Yorker. I'm not really a big fan of this magazine, but there it is. I pick it up. There's an article by Jane Mayer. You know what the article says? That in the days after September 11th, when nobody could fly, when all the planes were grounded, right? Nobody flew. Everything grounded. There was one private plane that flew around the skies of the United States of America, a private Saudi jet that went to four or five American cities to pick up about two dozen members of the bin Laden family and their associates. Are you aware of this? What the hell is that all about? I mean, I don't have the answer. I'm not really trying to draw any conclusions. But what is that about? What is that about? What do you mean? What, the FBI was furious. I mean, they told the Bush administration, hey, wait a minute. We're conducting a police investigation here. There's been a mass murder. Usually in a murder case, the police like to go and talk to the relatives. What do you know? Who do you know? What does he know? Where do you think he is? What can you tell us? How can you help us? Typical, right? Typical everyday police work, right? The FBI wanted to ask those questions. The Bush administration said, no, you are not to talk to a single bin Laden, and they are scooted out of the country. What is that all about? I would like to know, Mr. Bush. I'd like to know the financial connections between your family and the bin Laden family over the years. No. Oh, no. Let's go back before the Carlyle Group. Let's go to Arbusto. This is George W.'s first little oil venture that Daddy set him up with, you know, when he wasn't working for the first 18 years of his adult life. You know, you got to go to work. I'm going to set you up with a little company, Arbusto, Spanish for bush. Although I think it's actually Spanish for shrub, but it's some conglomeration of weeds. Arbusto.
Who was one of the main financial backers of Arbusto?
The Bin Laden family. This is back in the 80s, folks.
Carlyle Group, George Sr.'s little company he sets up after he leaves the White House with James Baker. Okay? So, and a bunch of other cronies of theirs, like Carlucci and a bunch of others, and Major, John Major from Britain. It's a private equity firm, and they do investments, and they line up defense contracts. And who's one of their biggest clients? The Bin Laden family. When George Sr. goes to stay in Saudi Arabia, he stays at the Bin Laden Palace. You know, there's pictures of this. There's little sleepovers at the Bin Ladens. And is this just a coincidence? Is something wrong with me? You know, the 6 billion people on this planet, you got two families, the Bushes and the Bin Ladens. One runs one country. One's trying to kill the people in that country. What's this? Just a coincidence? And they're friends, but yet there's something with the sons. What's this? What's this all about? I don't know. I'd like to know. Wouldn't you like to know? Wouldn't you like to know? 15 of the 19 hijackers from Saudi Arabia, yet we bomb Afghanistan. Did we miss? Did we, like, lob something and just, whoop, oh, we hit Afghanistan. No? As Ralph said the other day, we went over there to burn down a haystack to find a needle, and we couldn't find the needle. That's interesting. Isn't that strange? 15 of the 19 are from Saudi Arabia. Can't bomb the oil supply, can we? Can't bomb the business partners of Poppy, can we? Can't do that. No, can't do that. No, can't do that. You know, 15 of the 19 hijackers are from Cuba. Imagine this. 15 of the 19 from Cuba. Would we be bombing Peru? Exactly. You would laugh at that, wouldn't you? But dude, how many people in this country accepted, we got to go over there and bomb Afghanistan? Why? Because of the way they mistreated their women? Oh, we're suddenly concerned about that in Afghanistan? Hello, United States of America? You know? How about our buddies in Saudi Arabia? You know how they celebrated New Year's Day in Saudi Arabia this year? Chopped off the heads of 3 gay guys because they were gay. Yeah, that's our ally. That's our partner. Saudi Arabia has not let the FBI into the country, not once, since September 11th. They ask a single question of anybody. They will supply none of the documents. They will supply none of the stuff that shows the funding of Al-Qaeda from Saudi Arabia. They will not cooperate one single bit. Why? Because this was a military operation. It was a military operation conducted by elements within the Saudi regime. Friends, possibly, or not friends, or maybe the deal went south. Because if you go to the BBC website in 1995, it's right there, look it up on the web. 1995, Houston oil executives host a Taliban delegation in Houston. George W. Bush, governor of Texas. They're there to discuss the Unocal pipeline. They want to build a pipeline through Afghanistan to bring the natural gas from Central Asia through Afghanistan into Pakistan and out to the sea. 40% of the known natural reserves of natural gas on this planet are in Central Asia. So this is a big-ass deal. And they work with the Taliban for a number of years trying to make this thing happen. Who's going to build the pipeline? Who's going to help build the pipeline? A company called Halliburton. Who's the head of Halliburton? Big Dick Cheney. Okay, this stuff starts to stink to the high heavens, especially when you look at the money that Halliburton made rebuilding Kuwait after Daddy's War over there. And who helped Halliburton rebuild Kuwait? Who made the billions and the millions off this? A company called Enron. Enron and Halliburton rebuilding Kuwait. Oh, I don't want to go there, man. This really sucks. How bad does this get? We don't want to know, do we? We don't really want to know. Because if we really know, if the American people really know, they just might get so depressed, they'll just check out entirely. 50% already don't vote. How many won't vote after that? How many will just say, forget it. They're all corrupt. This is the sickest thing I've ever seen. I don't want anything to do with it. Or will they rise up and say, you know what? This is still our country. And you, Bush, you're the one who's unpatriotic. You're the one who's not the American. You're the one who is destroying this country.
That's Michael Moore on Stupid White Men. You're listening to Alternative Radio.
You, Bush, you use the cover of September 11th to try and get a tax bill for the rich under the cover of September. Oh, because of September 11th, we got to give more tax breaks, give more money back to the rich. That's your answer to that, Bush. Let's build more bombs. Let's give Lockheed the biggest contract ever given to a military contractor because of September 11th. A new stealth fighter bomber? What's that going to do? Stop the next box cutter? You know, if it's the box cutters you're worried about, if it's the guy with the lighted shoes, you know, just as an aside, Last time I saw a guy light his shoes on fire was a Motley Crue concert. It was around 87, 88. Some kid just puked on his own shoes and flew a match down there, and the whole shoe lit up. It was wild. But it appears that that was a real deal, and the guy, you know, had plastic explosives in his shoe, and he was going to light his shoe. Now, have you flown since then? Have you flown since Mr. Lighted Shoes? Have you flown? Yeah. What can't you bring through onto the plane? Toe clippers, nail clippers, pens, pencils, anything pointed, a needle. What else? What else are they? Safety pins, wire bras. I mean, it was just, no, I mean, it's really, I mean, there's a whole long list of things. You know what you can bring through? A butane lighter and a pack of matches. In fact, you can bring a box of matches if you want. Now, why is that? Because the FAA had put the butane lighters and the matches on, or the butane lighters on the list, the original list. Bush took it off. Bush, Ashcroft, FAA, they took it off. Why'd they take it off? Tobacco companies lobbied Bush and said, you take the butane lighters and the matches off, you're going to hurt our business. Yeah. You know the story? No, of course not. Yeah. No. It's okay. Nobody wants to write the story, right? I mean, just think about that. What is, you know, that is like a legitimate thing, I guess, that somebody actually did try to blow up a plane with that. You can break the butane out of there and start a nice little fire if you wanted to. Right? Why do you need a butane lighter and matches on an airplane to begin with? You can't smoke on it. So why do you need them? You know? But they'll listen to the tobacco companies first before they do anything to really actually try and protect us. They're not about protecting us. All right? They're trying to create what Orwell called the permanent war. I mean, this guy was like a f***ing genius, you know? I mean, I couldn't, you know, this is like the permanent, go back to 1984. It's the permanent war. The way to get the public completely, I mean, willing to give up their rights is to have them constantly afraid of some external enemy that's out there that you can't see, but's always there and is never going away. That's the war on terrorism. That's what they need us all freaked out about. Yeah, why did we give $43 million of our tax money to the Taliban in Afghanistan back last May? Check it out, May 22nd, LA Times. Yeah, that's right, because the Taliban signed on to the drug war. So we gave them $43 million of our tax money after we said they helped the people that blew up the USS Cole and the African embassies. If the average American knew that or understood that, how furious would they be? Think about that. $43 million of their money went to the so-called terrorists. Why? Because it was a bailout for the poppy farmers. The Taliban said to Bush, we'll join the war on drugs. So they signed up. And then they said, but our poppy farmers are going to be hurting now. So the Bush administration gave them money for a bailout to help the poppy farmers, you know. And this is really what's great about America. We'll bail out the airlines. We'll bail out Chrysler. We'll bail out the people who send the heroin to the United States. Can I read something here? What? Just want to read. I like reading this because this. They hated this chapter so much. This is from Kill Whitey. I don't know what it is, but every time I see a white guy walking toward me, I tense up. My heart starts racing, and I immediately begin to look for an escape route and a means to defend myself. I kick myself for even being in this part of town after dark. Didn't I notice the suspicious gangs of white people lurking on every street corner, drinking Starbucks, and wearing their gang colors of Gap turquoise or J. Crew mauve? What an idiot! Now the white person is coming closer, 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 and then he walks by without harming me, and I breathe a sigh of relief. White people scare the crap out of me. Now, this may be hard for you to understand, considering that I am white. But take a look back at my life with me, and you'll see a strange but unmistakable pattern emerging. Every person who has ever harmed me in my lifetime, the boss who fired me, the teacher who flunked me, the principal who punished me, the kid who hit me in the eye with a rock, the other kid who shot me with his BB gun, the executive who didn't renew TV Nation, the guy who was stalking me, the accountant who double paid my taxes, the drunk who smashed into me, the burglar who stole my stereo, the contractor who overcharged me, the girlfriend who left me, the next girlfriend who left me even sooner, the person in the office who stole checks out of my checkbook, every one of these individuals has been a white person. Coincidence? I think not. I have never been attacked by a black person, never been evicted by a black person, never had my security deposit ripped off by a black landlord, never had a black landlord, never had a meeting at a Hollywood studio with a black executive, never seen a black agent at my agency, never been puked on by a black teenager at a Motley Crue concert. I don't really go to that many Motley Crue concerts. I am so flawed. I'm on AOL. You know, I am a flawed individual. Think not highly of me. Never been pulled over by a black cop. Never been sold a lemon by a black car salesman. Never seen a black car salesman. Never had a black person deny me a loan. Never had a black person try to bury my movie. And I've never heard a black person say, "We're going to eliminate 10,000 jobs today. Have a nice day." You know, and yet when I turn on the news each night, what do I see again and again? Black men alleged to be killing, raping, mugging, stabbing, gangbanging, looting, rioting, selling drugs, pimping, hoeing, having too many babies, dropping babies from tenement windows, fatherless, motherless, godless, penniless. The suspect is described as a black male. The suspect is described as a black male. The suspect is described as a black male. No matter what city I'm in, the news is always the same. The suspect is always the same unidentified black male. I'm in Atlanta tonight, and I swear the police sketch of the black male suspect on TV looks just like the black male suspect I saw in the news last night in Denver and the night before in L.A. In every sketch, he's frowning, he's menacing, and he's wearing the same damn knit cap. Is it possible it's the same black guy committing every crime in America? There's a scene in Roger and Me where the woman who sells bunnies for pets or meat, she clubs a little bunny. And I know, and for the last 10 years, all I've heard is, you know, "Oh, that poor little bunny. Oh, that poor little bunny. Oh, how could you do that? How could you put that in the film? That poor little bunny. Oh. I mean, really, seriously, if I had a nickel for every time I heard that, man, I'd be running my own publishing company. But for the last 10 years, not once have I ever had somebody come up to me and say, 2 minutes later in the film, there's a black man who's shot on camera by the Flint police. He's wearing a Superman cape, you know, had a toy gun, please shoot him. I've never had one person say to me, "Oh, that black man. Oh, you, why'd you put that in the movie? That was horrible to watch him shot. Why? Oh, no, no, not once. Not once, because that's an image we accept. We're so used to seeing it. We're numb to it. We're numb to it. That's how sad it is that we've come to accept it. Oh, he's a black guy. He got shot. It's a black guy. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's another black guy. Just another black guy getting shot. Just another black guy. That's what they do. They get shot. They're black. This is America. Well, pass the potatoes." I don't want to live in that kind of country. I don't want to accept that. I don't want to accept that. And I don't know. But, of course, as we all know, race is used in a very skillful way to keep the working class, to keep their eyes on something so stupid and insignificant, so that those in power get to keep being in power,
so that we never focus our eyes on who the real enemy is, the 1% that own the 90% of the wealth. And there's something there's something seriously wrong when the top 1% get two political parties to do their bidding for them, and the other 99% of us get no party. There's something really, really wrong with that. And I'd like to see that change, in my lifetime, because we're going to look like idiots to the anthropologists who dig us up hundreds of years from now. Oh, seriously, think about that. I mean, they're going to look at this. They're going to be like dusting our brains, you know, trying to figure out what was it with these people. They kept running around saying they lived in a free society, and the 1% owned everything, controlled the two political parties. The other 99% were running around going, "Look at me, I'm free. I live in a democracy. Woohoo!" But I've always believed that the real changes occur in our society when just a few people are willing to take a risk. And you don't have to take a big risk either. You don't have to do a lot. You know, I think that we've got to broaden the tent here, the political tent. We've got to bring in other people, not just the political activists and the hardcore that might be in this room tonight, but we've got to bring all the slackers out there who really believe the same things we believe. They just don't like going to meetings, you know? I mean, I've been this way since I was a teenager. I was a lazy slacker teenager. I didn't like go to meetings or get involved in a whole lot. And it's just such a weird story. I was 16. I got selected to go to Boy State. Do you know what this is? Boy State. All right. It's Girl State. You know what? Each high school in the state selects 10 boys and 10 girls to go to the state capitol for a week and play government, where you run campaigns and you elect a governor and a lieutenant governor and, you know, different offices or whatever. It's for those kids that like to run for class treasurer all the time, you know. It's like, you know, I was never really into I got down there to Michigan State and I hated it. I stayed in the dorm room the whole time, just listened to music. One day I had the munchies. I go down the hall to the munchie machine, and I wanted to get, this was in the 70s, and I had this new potato chip then, Ruffles with the ridges. And like I thought, wow, this is cool, because I thought I was getting more chip per chip, you know, because of the mountain and mountains and mountains of chip. Anyways, so I go down to get the Ruffles, and I look up on the bulletin board by the munchie machine. It says, "Speech contest for Boy Staters on the life of Abraham Lincoln, sponsored by the Elks Club." And I'm going, oh, that's interesting, because I just happen to know that the Elks Club had a line on one of their application. I mean, not one of their. When you want to join the Elks Club, there's a line on there that says "Caucasians only." This is 1970s, you know. Back then it was legal for private groups to discriminate and segregate. Well, I thought, well, this is kind of ironic that they're sponsoring a speech contest on the life of the great emancipator, these f***ing bigots, you know. So I get my potato chips and I say, I'm going to write me a speech. So I go back to my room and I'm writing the speech out. How dare the Elks Club do this, you know. Besmirch the reputation of Abraham Lincoln, you know, blah, 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 blah. Racist bigots, you know. I show up the next day and I give the speech. There's no Elks Club guy there. It's a speech teacher from Lansing is the judge. I win the contest, you know. Then I've got to give it in front of all the Boy Staters, you know. And I'm like, got to remember, I'm like 16. I'm not in. This is already too much work. I was just doing it to mess around, you know. And so I'm on the stage. There's 3,000 Boy Staters. The Elks guy, the head of the Elks, is standing there with a big trophy to hand me, and he's just mortified listening to the speech, you know. And I say, I don't want your stinking trophy, you know. And I walk off the stage, and everybody applauds, and the reporter is down there, and he interviews me. He puts it out over the AP wire. 2 hours later, I get a phone call from a producer at the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. You know, and they're, we'd like you to come on the CBS Evening News tonight. Talk about what you did. And I'm going, oh, no way. No, no. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm thinking there's no amount of Clearasil that's going to save me from this, you know. I'm like,
So I don't go on. But they run the story anyways. Tonight in Lansing, Michigan, a young 16-year-old boy took on the Elks Club, an organization that discriminates against blacks and other people. Blah, 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 blah. The next day, there's like all these like calls for congressional investigations and hearings. And I mean, it just a storm hits Washington on these private groups that discriminate. 6 months later, the Elks are forced to integrate. All these other clubs got to integrate. And all because I just wanted a bag of potato chips. I mean, it was like... I learned at a very early age that you didn't have to do a hell of a lot to make something big happen. That's a horrible lesson to learn. Because then I'm like cursed the rest of my life. Geez, you know, I don't have to do a hell of a lot to get something done here. I skip ahead 2 years later. I'm a senior in high school. I used to get the paddle all the time. Back then they paddled you, you know. If you just the slightest infraction, your shirt tail was out. You looked at the principal the wrong way, you know. The assistant principal would get out the paddle, whack your ass, you know. I came home one day, my ass was so sore. I pick up the newspaper. It says, 18-year-olds given the right to vote, constitutional amendment, you know. And I flip it over, and it says, another story, school board president retiring, school board election to be held in June. I'm going, So I call up the county clerk, and I said, I just saw in the paper where it says we can vote now because we're 18. Can we run for office, too? Well, what office would you like to run for? School board. One moment, please. Comes back to the phone. Yes, you can run for school board at 18. Whoa, all right. And then I ran. Then right away I go, oh no, that's too much work. You know, I got like Star Trek to go watch here or something. You know, it's like I'm thinking I got to get thousands of signatures. You got to pay money to get on the ballot. Well, so what do you got to do to like get on the ballot? You know, to run. Like what do you got to do? You need 20 signatures. 20? That's it? 20? 20? I'm thinking, I know 20 stoners who would sign anything. You know, I just shoved the paper from... No, man, don't roll it. Just give it back to me. So that somebody runs an article on the paper about this long-haired kid that's running for school board, and he has only one position in his platform: fire the principal and assistant principal. I said, hey, that's two positions. Well, anyways, the adults in the community freak out. Six of them take out their petitions to run. They're going to stop this hippie, right? So... They split up the majority adult vote. And I get the stoner vote, and I become the first 18-year-old in the country elected to public office, you know? Nine months later, I convinced the school board to fire the principal and assistant principal. I've lived my whole life around women. I have two sisters, no brothers. You know, wife, one daughter. It's I've always been, you know, I got housebroken a long time ago. What guys need to do is we need to, like, instead of, you know, joining feminist groups or whatever, or calling ourselves feminist men or whatever, we need to really... we need to work on each other, you know. Take back the night, that's a good idea. We need to take back our bullshit. That would be a better idea. And if you just went home tonight and just thought about, even though, because you're thinking to yourself, geez, I'm a pretty good guy, I'm a decent guy, I'm progressive thinking, and I'm not sexist in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, really, just if you just did a little self-examination and think about what could you do to make the world a little bit better place and make it easier for women to open, you know, so that those doors are opening just as wide and as fast for them as they do for us.
You see, the thing is that no matter, you know, how good of a guy you think I am, I'm ahead of you already. The playing field is not level. That door will always open for me faster and wider than it will for you. I'm so angry about the fact, about just the simple little thing, that there's never a woman nominated for president. And this is like, I mean, this is so outrageous. I really want to start a movement where we have some vote strike or do something where it says we are no longer going to vote until we see women on the ballot. And we're not just going to do nothing about it. I mean, we're going to go and actively get women to run. Because we do want to vote, and we should vote. But we got to take a really hardcore stance on this, folks. It will never change. Liberals keep saying it, but it never changes. The Democrats don't change it, all right? We've got to change this. Look, I have a daughter. She's 20 years old now. I want her to believe that she can have anything she wants, do anything she wants, and I don't want her having to struggle in this way to have her voice heard and then squelched. And I'll tell you, it has been, if you have girls, if you had girls, or if you are girls yourself and you've gone through this, to see those girls, to see her back there in grade school, man, when the girls ran every year, man, they ran the class. They did, and they were like in charge. They were taller than the boys. They were stronger. They were faster. You know, and then something weird happens around junior high or high school or something. It just flips the other way, and the girls get quiet. They let the boys take over. Now the boys are taller, they're stronger, they're louder, you know. And it's like the girls are 10 times smarter, you know, but somehow they just hang back, you know. Let these dumbass boys run everything, you know. It's like, it's just so weird, you know. I don't want her to live in that kind of world. So I'm committed to changing it every day of my life, and I mean it when I say it. And I have my own affirmative action programs going where we work. That and you know, you can look at the credits. You can see that I will always look to try and bring more women into this field. We set up a fund after Roger and me because I started thinking about, geez, this is really weird that African-American women in this country have never had, there's not been, at that point, this was 1990, not a single African-American woman had ever had a film distributed by a Hollywood studio. 100 years of film, this is an art form essentially invented in this country, what is that, like 7% of the population have no voice in this thing that I do for a living? That's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. 100 years. So we set up a fund where we did nothing but provide grants and funds for African American women filmmakers to try and get some more films out there, and we helped this young woman who made this independent film called Just Another Girl on the IRT get her film made, get it through, and get Miramax to pick it up, and it was finally distributed as the first film by a major studio in America. And I was so proud of that, and I just thought, we got to just keep this going in our own little way to make it more accessible to women. And in terms of race, as I've you'll read this in my book, you'll think I'm probably half cracked, but I've just so had it with this business I'm in. It is an all-white business. All-white business. You just don't run into black writers, black directors, black producers, black camera guys, women. You know, I just figured I've got to do something radical about this. So I made a decision this year. I'm not hiring any more white people. And we're the problem. We're the ones who do need to talk about these issues and change what's going on, all right? Don't fall into the weird liberal PC thing of, you know, we've got to, and of course we do, but we don't need to do it symbolically, reaching out. We need to do it aggressively and actively. So one way I'm going to aggressively do it is, and I did it while I was writing the book, and literally the next four people I hired, both on this Columbine film when we were in post-production and in research for my book, were all black. And I just, I'm sure I'm breaking the law. I'm sure you can't, you know, do that. But it's like, I don't care. I'm going to drive a big-ass wedge in this thing, and I'm going to say, you know, I'm hiring black people, black
black, 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 and I'm going to get black people in this industry, and I'm going to hire women, and I'm going to do what I can do in my own small way. Remember, I'm not perfect. I'm not Mother Teresa. I'm on AOL. I've got a link to Amazon.com on my website. I'm seriously flawed. Don't think I'm any great shit here. I'm just saying it bugs me personally. I am personally going to do something about it. Promise me tonight that you leave here and do something, even if it's a little thing. Don't go to a four-hour meeting in the basement of the Unitarian Church, you know, tomorrow night and burn yourself out, all right? Just do a little thing. Call the White House, 202-456-1414. Ask Bush the 5 questions. Ask him to join me at Enron Field on the opening day of baseball season when the Brewers play the Astros at 4:05 p.m. opening day. That's the day I want Bush to show up, stand in the middle of Enron Field, and resign. Bring Cheney with you. Let's... There'll be a change in November, and until then, we can see how Dennis Hassert and Strom Thurmond run the country. I'm in for a good laugh. How about you? I think that'd be great. So, anyways, thank you very much for coming. You're very kind. Go ahead and raise some hell. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Michael Moore on Stupid White Men. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado. Moore directed the award-winning documentary Roger and Me. His television series include The Awful Truth and the Emmy-winning TV Nation. His first book, Downsize This, was a bestseller. His latest book, Stupid White Men, is wildly popular, topping many of the bestseller lists. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent award-winning weekly series featuring diverse voices such as Noam Chomsky, Winona LaDuke, Ralph Nader, Cornel West, and Angela Davis. To access our catalog, visit our website at www.alternativeradio.org. Again, website, www.alternativeradio.org. David Barsamian is AR's director. I'm Jeff Friesen. Thank you for listening.